Okay. Our next talk on Jimmy Giuffre will be done by Peter Johnston, who is a bassist and composer living in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. He is currently working on a master's in composition at York University, where his research focuses on the incorporation of improvisation into composition. This work has led him to investigate the work of avant-garde jazz composers of the 1960s. Let's have a nice round of applause for Peter Johnston.
Okay, thanks a lot. I'll apologize in advance. I've got a little bit of a cold, so I could have a little bit of trouble, but I'll do my best. Today, I'll be discussing the music of Texas-born composer and multi-instrumentalist Jimmy Giuffre. Giuffre is best known for his swing-era composition, Four Brothers, while his contributions to avant-garde jazz in the 1950s and 60s has been largely unacknowledged. This presentation focuses specifically on the album Fusion, released as Verve 8397 in 1961. Fusion is the first of two studio albums recorded for Verve Records by the Jimmy Giuffre Three, featuring Giuffre on clarinet, Paul Blais on piano, and Steve Swallow on double bass. This incarnation of the Three was an extension of musical concepts Giuffre had been working on since the mid-1950s. I feel that the recordings contain innovations that merit more attention than they have received up to now. Fusion was not well received at the time of its release, and indeed went out of print until 1992, when ECM Records re-released both Fusion and its follow-up Thesis as the double album 1961. These two albums, along with 1962's Free Fall on Columbia, demonstrate that Giuffre was an important figure in the jazz avant-garde. Free Fall marked the end of a decade of recording work for Giuffre, as the lack of critical and audience acceptance of his work made it difficult for him to secure recording contracts and to continue fronting a working band. He was record only rarely for the next 30 years and moved somewhat reluctantly into a teaching career when he was unable to get enough work as a performer and composer. To begin, I'll briefly discuss Giuffre's early work as it relates to the music on Fusion. Jimmy Giuffre was born in Dallas, Texas in 1921, and his musical education started early. He played in both classical ensembles and jazz bands throughout his university years at North Texas State University. After a four-year posting in an Air Force orchestra, Giuffre moved to Los Angeles in 1946. While in L.A., he worked as a performer, composer, and arranger for various band leaders, including Jimmy Dorsey. In 1947, the Woody Herman Band recorded his composition Four Brothers, written to feature the now legendary saxophone section of the Herman Band. This is where I first heard of him, as I tried to get that tricky saxophone melody under my fingers for my high school jazz band. Giuffre is well represented in Ted Goya's book West Coast Jazz, Modern Jazz in California, 1945 to 1960, where he's recognized as helping to define the West Coast sound. Giuffre continued to be active in Los Angeles in the early 1950s, appearing as a leader and sideman on many recordings. Goya's book gives an adequate account of Giuffre's early development, but his work of the 1960s is only briefly mentioned as it occurred after the time frame focus of the book. Giuffre's output became more individual starting in the mid-1950s. Much of his work from this time is informed by his study of counterpoint. Giuffre, as well as many other West Coast jazz musicians he was associated with, studied composition with a man named Dr. Wesley LaViolette. LaViolette introduced Giuffre to the formal study of European counterpoint, which became the driving force behind his compositions for small jazz ensemble. In this quote from the 1950s, Giuffre expanded on his ideas of counterpoint and how it relates to jazz music and musicians. In studying counterpoint, I began to see that each man wants to express his own individuality. I began to think, if this man is playing, why not give him a part to play that's good? Give the guitar, give the bass, or whatever I use, a line that sounds like he's playing his own melody. Once I discovered counterpoint, this was my direction, and I'm sure it will continue to be. This statement points directly to the musical concepts that Jufri worked with for the trio with Paul Blais and Steve Swallow. His interest in multiple melodic lines led to his foregoing of the drums for his small group work. He felt that the resonance of the drums and the cymbals obscured the sounds of the lines he was writing, as well as masking the timbres of the instruments. This ideal informed the music of Jufri's best-known small group, the drummerless trio with Jim Hall on guitar and Ralph Pina on bass or Bob Brookmeyer on valve trombone. Jufri himself seemed to believe his abandonment of drums was his most radical move. When Graham Locke asked him in 1994 what he thought lay behind that Kafka-esque blackballing a quarter of a century ago, Jufri replied, "Well, I got into the free jazz, and I didn't use any drums, so some people didn't think it was jazz." Despite the absence of drums, Jufri's trio with Pena and Hall fits well into the jazz tradition, as each player infuses the music with a strong swing feeling. In hindsight, there's no mistaking the swing lineage of this group. Jufri conceived his group with Jim Hall to be more about composition than improvisation. There are lengthy composed sections in the music and only brief improvisations. The most famous piece for this trio, The Train and the River, is a good example of Jufri's compositional approach of the time. Throughout this piece, none of the instruments are restricted to their traditional roles, as each instrument is featured in a lead role at different points. While this loosening of roles no doubt sounded adventurous to listeners of the time, the harmonic and melodic material is very familiar. Many of Jufri's tunes from this time era are blues-based, while others, such as The Train and the River, have a folk country feel. Jufri also tackled some long-form suite compositions with this band, stretching the limits of his trio instrumentation. Many of the concepts formed in this earlier group remain in the Blais Swallow trio, while the musical aesthetic becomes more abstract. Jufri was excited about his new sidemen, saying about Blais and Swallow, "I found the right people to play with, that listen to each other and aren't greedy." Other than the addition of the piano on Fusion, the most striking difference from Jufri's earlier trio is the change in the compositions. Jufri left behind the through-composed forms and ensemble passages of his early works in favor of a more open concept that allowed for more greater focus on improvisation. The folk and blues flavors of the preceding trio compositions are replaced by a more avant-garde, pointillistic, chromatic style. While there's still a strong blues influence on Fusion, this influence drifts further back on Thesis and Freefall. Somewhat ironically, as this music further alienated Jufri from the jazz audience, he was returning to a more traditional jazz performance practice of melody solos melody, with the horn as the clear lead instrument on the melodies. Perhaps the labeling of Jufri's music as non-jazz by some critics comes from the incorporation of European elements into his music, especially his emphasis on melodic counterpoint. The quiet nature of the music on Fusion makes it incompatible for clubs or dancing, but more appropriate for concert halls. In his own liner notes for his 1956 album, The Jimmy Jufri Clarinet, he states his claim to a chamber jazz aesthetic. It has been said that when jazz gets soft, it loses its gusto and funkiness. It is my feeling that soft jazz can retain the basic flavor and intensity that it has at a louder volume, and at the same time, perhaps, reveal some new dimensions of feeling that loudness obscures. The Blais Swallow Trio makes deliberate use of quiet and silence on Fusion. One can hear the timbre of the instruments as a part of the foreground texture. We are also able to hear many extra musical sounds as well, such as Jufri's breathing, blowing unpitched air through his horn, and Blais and Swallow singing along quietly to their own lines. The opening notes of the album, of the tune Jesu Maria, set the contemplative tone for the rest of the album. As in Jufri's earlier groups, the musicians in this trio are given written parts to play. While sounding improvised, these parts are the same on the heads in and the heads out, so we know they're deliberate and planned. Whether these parts were fully written out by Jufri or agreed upon during rehearsals and or performances and retained as part of the composition is unclear. Unless you've watched an improvising ensemble every night, there's often no way to tell which parts of the performances are new and which ones have become part of the musical language of the group. The session photograph shows the musicians all looking at music stands, so there was clearly something written for them to follow. Despite the absence of traditional forms in these pieces, the improvisations are not as unstructured as they may first appear to be. Each piece is in the strophic form, or in the jazz vernacular, head solos head. This means that the improvisations, while not based on a cyclical harmonic structure, do have a larger structure to adhere to. The improvisations are also highly referential to the given material of the composition. Along with these forms and approaches, the trio keeps their statements brief. They don't stretch out too far on each tune, keeping the performances short and concise. The tunes average around 5 minutes on this album. This trio also keeps with Jufri's ideas of flexible instrumental roles. Jufri has said that he views the instruments of his trio as interchangeable, that any one of them can fill any role at any time. As an example, Swallow rarely walks quarter notes, in contrast to traditional jazz bass playing. When he does walk, his lines do not outline any particular harmony, but rather emphasize the pulse and the mood of the tune. Emphasis is a good example of this, where a blues feel is generated without Swallow outwardly playing any blues changes. The bass is most often treated in an anchoring role, as we heard earlier on Jesu Maria. Another example of this bass as anchor is the aptly titled Trudgeon. Here the bass holds down the harmony and pulse, but in a sparse fashion that allows for flexibility in the upper parts. I love that title, Trudgeon, for that one. The improvisations coming out of these bass parts continue to feature Swallow as providing a foundation, with occasional leaps into the higher register to engage in conversation with the other two voices. Other pieces feature the bass in a more melodic role. Most notable is Venture, where the bass has a melodic voice equal to the other's instruments in a fugal structure. Did I say fugal? I meant fugal. On the following two albums by this trio, the bass becomes a more independent voice. But the contemplative mood of fusion seems to be best served by the bass playing a foundational role. Pianist Paul Blais' approach to the piano is well suited to the linear, non-harmonic nature of this music. He does not comp in the traditional jazz fashion, treating the piano more like a rhythmic and melodic instrument than a harmonic one. Throughout fusion, he uses voicings of two or three notes placed close together, only rarely playing larger chords. These small, triad-free voicings enable Blais to provide the rhythmic propulsion of comping without fencing in the harmony. Examples of these tight voicings appear in Scootin' About, Jesu Maria, and this example, Afternoon. Blais' other common chordal approach uses two or three note voicings spread widely apart, covering fourths or larger dissonant intervals. The distance between notes in these voicings again serves to obscure the harmonic functions of the chords. Examples of this occur in Cry Want, In the Mornings Out There, and this piece, Emphasis. Thank you. right, that's all my examples. I got through it. The equipment worked. That's great. Blay takes care to stay out of the range of the bass and the clarinet, and is most often heard between the two. This range consideration is especially clear in the composed sections. Like Jewelfrey, Blay seems to want to explore the sound of his instrument, allowing each note to ring out and decay into the underbrush of the sonic landscape. The sparseness of Blay's playing allows for both increased complexity in the melodies and maximum flexibility in the improvisations. The clarinet is the most distinctive timbre in the collective sound of this trio and sets the mood for each pitch on fusion. Jewelfrey's decision to exclude his saxophone collection implies that he viewed this trio specifically as a vehicle for his clarinet playing. In contrast, in some of his earlier trio recordings, such as The Train and the River, Jewelfrey can be heard on all of his major doubles in the space of one tune. Jewelfrey's approach to the clarinet is to use it texturally as much as melodically. In the improvised sections, he moves back and forth from a solo to an accompanimental role. As an accompanist, Jewelfrey displays his swing roots by riffing under the soloist. These short rhythmic figures propel the music along, a strategy often employed by Jewelfrey's West Coast contemporary Jerry Mulligan in his pianoless quartets. Like Blay, Jewelfrey chooses notes and melodies that reflect and develop the pitch material of the melody without clearly articulating a harmonic structure. He seems interested in developing the material and motives of the melodies in a linear fashion, with maximum emphasis on the sound of his instrument. There's a common thread of purpose and approach throughout each of the pieces on Fusion. While much of the trio's approach, as established on this album, were developed on later recordings, Fusion has a stillness and spaciousness that they did not repeat. I feel the great care was taken to make each tune unique and reveal different facets of the trio's sound at different times. Although each piece is the same head solos head format, the way the instruments are deployed in each composition is varied, and this informed the way the musicians improvise around the composed material. There's also much variety in the material used to construct each composition, from the simplest blues and modal melodies to chromatic atonal fugues. This has been the most interesting part of this project for me, seeing how the amount of variety Jimmy Jewelfrey is able to get out of these really miniature structures. And the way that they're able to function as springboards for improvisation while being complete compositional statements in themselves. To conclude, I hope that this paper has provided an introduction to Jimmy Jewelfrey's music that will encourage those not familiar with it to explore it a little further. It is unfortunate that this particular trio did not record very much and that Jewelfrey's work has gone so under-recognized. Ted Goya's closing comments on Jimmy Jewelfrey's legacy are telling of Jewelfrey's position in the jazz tradition. He writes, "If Jewelfrey is largely unacknowledged as a pioneer, he perhaps has only himself to blame. The extraordinary diversity of his musical output has made the exact nature of his contributions to jazz difficult to pinpoint for all but his most devoted fans. Homage from the younger generation, whether musicians or critics, has not, however, been at all apparent, nor is it likely to be forthcoming." In response to these comments, I would like to share the personal experiences that led me to this music. I first heard about this trio through an instructor while I was attending the Banff Center for the Arts Jazz Workshop. The following day, one of my fellow students, independent of this instructor, brought in a chart of afternoon for our ensemble to play, saying how excited he was about this music he had discovered. When I got home, with some effort, I tracked down 1961 and Free Fall. A year later, I heard Jesu Maria on a CD by young New York saxophonist Mark Turner. Then, while getting my notes together for this project, I heard a public radio broadcast of a jazz quartet of musicians younger than myself performing an original composition dedicated to Jimmy Jewelfrey titled Unsung. With these stories in mind, it seems that time may prove Mr. Goya wrong, and Jewelfrey's music may yet become known to a wider audience. Thank you. Thanks. Any questions? Yes. I actually haven't heard Tangents in Jazz. I've read a lot about it, but it sounds interesting.
It's a great disservice to have that album is not in print.
Yeah, so much is out of print. It's hard to find stuff with the trio with Jim Hall as well. There's only a couple CDs. It's all hard to come by. Even the ECM re-release of these albums is hard to find.
I'll make a CD of it.
Okay, that'd be great. Thanks. I don't know if it ever came out on CD, did it?
No.
You have it on LP? Yeah. Yeah.
Any other questions?
Can I ask another?
Sure.
Please.
Go right ahead. Got plenty of time.
Did you get a chance to speak with
No, I didn't get a chance to speak with him. I'm not sure if he does interviews. I know he's not in great health. Yeah, he has Parkinson's disease quite badly. I think he hasn't played in 10 years. I don't think. Yeah, he's getting up there. Yeah.
Peter, I have a question. Well, why do you think he's been sort of overlooked when they talk about avant-garde leaders of that time?
Well, his music is very. It's a lot different than a lot of the other kind of free jazz that was going on. He had a lot of classical influence, a lot of kind of atonal nature to it. He really studied the counterpoint thing, and it doesn't have the kind of. It's kind of quiet. It doesn't have the kind of immediacy of Ornette Coleman or somebody like that. It's real listening music, and not. I don't mean to say unemotional, but definitely, doesn't grab, and it's not as controversial in some ways as the.
Was he based more on the West Coast, sort of than?
At this time, he was in New York.
He
was in L.A. and he moved to New York, and that's where he met Paul Blay and Steve Swallow, who, incidentally, I think are really responsible for the sound of this. Band, those two guys really made it sound the way it did, and like I said, how it's hard to tell which parts are written by him and which parts that those musicians played, because I transcribed all this stuff, and just those parts fit so well into the general styles of those other two players that it's hard to imagine if he wrote them or where they came up with them or what. But
maybe the fact that his music is somewhat as structured as it is, probably didn't do him any good.
Yeah, it was, but it got progressively more out. Like this album, it's hard to hear what was so sort of why people had such difficulty with this one. But on the next one, it got further out, and then Free Fall is totally out. There's no structure. There's no tunes. There's no nothing. And like clarinet solos, they're just a lot of noise. Much more avant-garde, and that was really the end of it for him. He didn't put out another record after that. In 62 until the 80s, I think, or maybe early or late 70s, and only sporadically since then.
Any other questions? Well, let's have a nice round of applause. Nice done. Nicely done.
Thank you.
Really? Yeah, no problem.